This audio recording is protected under U.S. copyright laws. It is produced by Nichols Patrick CPE and provided by your State Society of CPAs for your personal, non-commercial use. Further reproduction, distribution, or commercial use of this recording without written permission from Nichols Patrick is prohibited. Requests for permission to reproduce this material should be addressed to Nichols Patrick CPE, Suite A, 973 West Liberty Street, Hubbard, Ohio, 44425. Welcome to the weekly tax update for December 2nd, 2013. Even though it was a short week, it was a busy week for tax developments. Our first development is a Second Circuit decision affirming that Thomas Gluckman and his wife were in fact liable for a significant deficiency related to the distribution of cash value life insurance from a failed 419 AF6 welfare benefit plan, one of those tax shelters that didn't work. Then we have a TAM in which the IRS determines that a professional employer organization is not entitled to claim the Section 45B credit for FICA paid on tips received by its clients' employees. This is another round, of course, in whether the professional employer organization is the statutory employer or the common law employer. This ruling finds that it is neither, which is kind of interesting, I think. Then we have an extension granted to elect a foreign earned income exclusion, and we'll talk a little bit about the circumstances of that. Then compensatory damages, including lost wages, according to the IRS, are excludable from gross income if it is determined that a damage award was received on account of personal physical injury or sickness. This is a departure from what I thought the rule was. I thought that damages that lost wages were always going to be taxable as wages, whereas the other damages in that package could be excluded based on physical injury or physical damage. And a U.S. District Court in Wisconsin has ruled in favor of the Freedom from Religion Foundation that a rental allowance paid to a minister cannot be excluded from the minister's gross income. It is an unconstitutional violation of the Establishment Clause to provide such a tax-free benefit to a minister. Then we have in James Alton Tucker, a ruling that an individual cannot deduct health insurance premium payments made to his former wife in that they are not deductible as alimony by him or taxable as alimony to her. Then the big news, of course, final regulations on net investment tax. Unless you happen to be a minister and there is some chance that after a year or two here of going through the courts, it's possible that your parsonage allowance will be taxable. But the final regulations on the net investment tax are the big news from last week, along with proposed regulations for those parts of the guidance that were not originally issued in the proposed regulations back in December of 2012. We have a lot of reading to do, a lot of catching up to do. And then, in what will probably not be the last shot in the battle between conservative groups and the Internal Revenue Service Exempt Organization Division, we have proposed regulations that define candidate-related political activity for 501c4 groups. Well, that's a big agenda. Let's get started. In Thomas Gluckman, the Second Circuit Court of Appeals affirmed a tax court memo decision back in 2012, Memo 2012-329. Specifically, the IRS had determined a deficiency of $754,000 plus a Section 6662A penalty of $151,000 with respect to the Gluckman's joint federal income tax returns for 2003. The issues were whether the Gluckmans were required to include in their income the value of two cash value insurance policies on their lives that were held by a purported Section 419 AF6 welfare benefit plan from which their employer withdrew, and whether as a result of that deficiency, the Gluckmans are liable for an accuracy-related penalty. The decision of the Second Circuit Court of Appeals doesn't make very interesting reading, but the original TC Memo does, and I recommend that you go back and read TC Memo 2012-329 to get a good understanding of how tax shelters that look so good and sound so good and are so heavily promoted can go so wrong. Our next item is a Technical Advice Memorandum 2013-47020, in which the IRS determines that a professional employer organization is not entitled Claim the Section 45 capital B credit for FICA tax paid on tips received by its client's employees in connection with providing, delivering, or serving food or beverages for consumption on the premises. The PEO performed specified activities related to human resources for its clients under what it referred to as a co-employment arrangement. As part of that arrangement, the PEO claimed to become an, quote, employer of record, close quote, allowing it to relieve the client of administrative burdens for matters such as employment tax and insurance-related paperwork. Other responsibilities under the arrangement included payroll processing, employee benefits such as health and welfare programs, life insurance, workers' compensation insurance, and all human resources functions such as background checks, employment testing, and customized employee handbooks. So let's take a look at exactly what Section 45 capital B says. 45BA provides that for purposes of the general business credit against tax, the employer Social Security credit for the tax year is an amount equal to the excess employer Social Security tax paid or incurred by the taxpayer during the year. 45BB1 defines excess employer Social Security tax as the employer portion of the FICA tax paid on tips that are deemed to have been paid by the employer to an employee. The statute goes on to provide that the person entitled to the credit is the taxpayer that incurs the employer portion of the FICA. Since the PEO bills the employer portion of the FICA through to the statutory employer, the IRS had no trouble concluding that under these facts, under the particular facts and circumstances, and they're not really all that unique, the PEO was not the employer of its client's employees. That being the case, the PEO was neither the common law employer nor the statutory employer under Section 3401 D1. It did not incur the employer portion of the FICA tax for purposes of the tips received and was not entitled to claim the Section 45B credit. Next, we have Letter Ruling 2013-47-016, in which the IRS grants an individual an extension to elect the foreign earned income exclusion under Section 911 for a particular tax year. Well, we thought that had to be done on a timely filed tax return, so let's find out how this was done. The taxpayer in question worked in a foreign country for 2 years. His employer engaged the services of an accounting firm to complete the taxpayer's U.S. and local income tax returns for both years. The same accounting firm worked with the company to collect information necessary for it to issue Forms W-2 and corrected Forms W-2. When the accounting firm prepared the taxpayer's returns for the 2 years, they failed to advise the taxpayer to make the election, the 9/11 election, to exclude $90,000 of income, and failed to advise the taxpayer of the consequences of not making the election. In connection with this ruling request, the taxpayer has submitted an affidavit signed under penalties of perjury describing the events that led to the failure to make the election. Taxpayer relied on the advice of accounting firm B. The taxpayer has also submitted affidavits of the company, his employer, and the accounting firm, corroborating the statements that are made by the taxpayer. It is significant to the ruling that the requirement for making the election with a timely filed return is in the regulations at 1.911-7A. That means that we can request relief from the filing requirement under Regulation 301.9100-3. That's what the taxpayer does here. And with the affidavits from the employer and the accounting firm, the IRS grants the ruling request. Next, we have a very brief electronic communications, ECC 2013-46010, addressing the whether or not a damage award received on account of personal, physical, or injury can be partially related to lost wages and or not. Here's the full content of the Chief Counsel email. Subject, your question. Once it has been determined that the damages were received on account of personal, physical injury, or physical sickness, all compensatory damages, including lost wages, are excludable from gross income under Section 104A2. The memo writer goes on then to refer to Revenue Ruling 85-97, and he cites precedent Schleyer, S-C-H-L-E-I-E-R, 515 U.S. 323 in 1996. If you have an issue of that type and kind, you'll want to follow the IRS's roadmap. Well, this is one we knew was coming. This issue's been rattling around the federal courts at low levels and been the subject of speeches by various special interest groups since the Ninth Circuit's consideration of Richard Warren, a parsonage allowance, that Rick Warren being the author of The Purpose-Driven Life. In any event, the citation on this is Freedom from Religion Foundation et al. Versus Jacob Lew being the Secretary of the Treasury. And this is a U.S. District Court in Wisconsin, determining that Section 107, parentheses, numeral 2, which excludes the rental allowance paid to a minister from gross income, is an unconstitutional violation of the Establishment Clause, and enjoined its enforcement, finding that it provides a benefit to religious persons that it does not give others. The Freedom from Religion Foundation and its co-presidents filed this suit in U.S. District Court, challenging the availability of federal income tax exemptions for ministers of the gospel. U.S. District Judge Barbara Crabb rejected the government's argument that the Freedom from Religion Foundation lacked standing to challenge the law. She ruled that the injury is clear from the face of the statute and that FFRF was not required to first claim the exemption and have it rejected before filing suit. Ms. Crabb said she found it difficult to take seriously the government's argument that the co-presidents of Freedom from Religion Foundation might qualify as ministers of the gospel, concluding that the statute denied these laypersons an exemption, that they suffered an injury, and that the injury was traceable to those in the government who implemented the tax code. She then addressed the merits of the case and found that the U.S. Supreme Court's decision in Texas Monthly, Inc. versus Bullock, that based on the Supreme Court's decision in Texas Monthly Incorporated versus Bullock, the exemption in Section 107, parentheses 2, violates the Establishment Clause. This, of course, is not over. This battle will take 2 or 3 years to play out in the federal courts and ultimately will be decided by the U.S. Supreme Court. Look for that about 2016-2017. Next, a tax court summary opinion, 2013-94, ruling that James Alton Tucker could not claim a deduction for health insurance premium payments made to his former wife as alimony, and therefore they were not deductible by Mr. Tucker. The problem Mr. Tucker had was the wording in the final court order. In April of 2009, he was divorced from his wife, and the court, exercising jurisdiction over the divorce proceedings, issued a memorandum identifying and distributing the marital estate and awarding support. With respect to child and spousal support, the trial court ordered Mr. Tucker to pay his former wife $2,414 per month. The trial court further ordered Mr. Tucker to provide for Mrs. Tucker's health insurance in the amount of $1,400 per month. In August of 2009, the final divorce decree was issued. In that final divorce decree, the court incorporated its own memorandum, which ordered, and here's a quote from the memorandum, upon entry of the final decree of divorce, husband shall pay to wife the sum of $1,400 per month in addition to spousal support to assist wife in paying health insurance premiums. This is not in the nature of spousal support and shall not be taxable to wife nor deductible by husband for income tax purposes. Mr. Tucker appealed the trial court's order, arguing that the trial court did not have the authority to designate what was and was not alimony, and he lost his appeal in state court. He proceeded to deduct the $1,400 a month as alimony anyway. It didn't work out. A state domestic relations court order can establish what is and is not alimony. Once that is done, then you go to the federal law, and alimony is deductible by the person paying it and income to the person receiving it, but the determination of alimony is made based on the divorce decree and orders of the state domestic relations court. On November 26th, the IRS issued both final regulations on most of Section 1411, the new 3.8% tax that's imposed on some net investment income of individuals, estates, and trusts that have income above the statutory threshold amounts, and proposed regulations for those issues that it had failed to issue proposed regulations for back in December of 2012. So we have on the 26th of November, we have both TD 9644 and Reg 130843-13, the first, the final regulations, and the second, proposed regulations dealing with other parts of Section 1411. We're talking about 200 pages of regulations here altogether, so you're going to have to do some reading of your own. I can't cover all that in this short program, but the final regulations generally follow the approach of the proposed regs, with a few modifications to address some of the comments, modifications such as the calculation of net investment income, how the various aspects of Section 469 and Section 1411 interact, and the treatment of several special types of trusts, how to calculate the gain from the sale of an interest in a partnership or S corporation, and a few areas in which the regulations are simplified, final regs are simplified from the original proposed regulations. The final regulations, TD 9644, those are effective December the 2nd, 2013. The proposed regulations, of course, will be effective 90 days after they are adopted final in the Federal Register. I rather expect that it looks like the IRS has all this on a fast track. I expect that we will get final regulations sometime in the spring on what is current, what was proposed on November 26th. So, in any event, stay tuned, stay alert. This is going to be really important for every client where you have more than $200,000 of modified adjusted gross income for a single person, or $250,000 or more for a married filing joint, and you have investment income. It's going to be particularly complex for beneficiaries of trusts and the owners of pass-through entities who sell an interest. But the regulations attempt to give us guidance. It's just going to be a chore to get it all incorporated into what we understand and can work with. Finally, this week, on November 29th, 2013, we got proposed regulations defining candidate-related political activities for social welfare groups. As defined in the proposed regs, candidate-related political activity includes communications that expressly advocate for a clearly identified political candidate, communications made within 60 days of a general election, or within 30 days of a primary election, that clearly identify a candidate or political party, and communications expenditures that must be reported to the Federal Election Commission. Candidate-related political activity also includes any contribution that is recognized under campaign finance law as a reportable contribution, and grants to Section 527 political organizations and other tax-exempt organizations that conduct candidate-related political activities. The regs provide that a grantor may rely on a written certification from a grantee stating that it does not engage in and will not use grant funds for candidate-related political activity. Other candidate-related political activities identified in the proposed regs include voter registration drives and get-out-the-vote drives, distribution of material prepared by or on behalf of a candidate or by a Section 527 political organization, preparation or distribution of voter guides that refer to candidates or political parties and events held within 60 days of a general election or within 30 days of a primary election at which a candidate appears as part of the program. These regulations are proposed to apply on the date final regulations are published in the Federal Register, which you can bet is going to be fairly soon, given all the heat that is associated with this particular issue. Well, that's a wrap for this week. And as usual, our best advice to you, stay safe.